axe hefted, but nothing happened, although the runes continued to glow. The wind was getting up. Samusin seemed to take a pleasure in terrorizing the dwarf. Gusts passed between the bleached bones of the tower, and every now and then Tungdil heard a mournful whistle, like the muted scream of a soul whose bones had found no rest. Eye sockets glared at him accusingly from weathered skulls. Tungdil's instincts warned him to venture no further. Heart pounding wildly, he strode to the entrance, pushed past the open door, and stepped into the tower. The outer cladding of bone was obviously intended as decoration or as a sign of elvish power, for the tower was made of wood and stone. The passageways were hung with portraits, and Tungdil knew without looking too closely that the pictures weren't painted on canvas or with ordinary paint. Like their elven cousins, the Alfar were natural artists, masters of the easel and brush, but they put their painterly talents to darker use. He heard a sudden noise behind him. Somewhere in the tower, a door had slammed, and the noise resonated through the high-ceilinged passageways, lingering in the air. The last remaining lamps, the others had run out of fuel, flickered dangerously.
"Who's there?"
He turned round and swallowed.
"Come out and show yourself!"
Silence reigned. With growing dread, he continued down the passageway and came at last to a lofty door of Tionium, inscribed with mysterious elvish runes. It's bound to be here. He pushed the door open and peered into a chamber of black marble. The chamber was hall-like in its proportions and peopled with strange statues made from the bones of many creatures. Some were painted, others bound with gold wire or Tionium, or inlaid with gems and precious metals. Pictures, mosaics, and bizarre weaponry decorated the walls. At the center of the chamber, steps led up to a pair of empty thrones. The glittering of diamonds alerted Tungdil to the axe. Keenfire was hanging from the wall behind the thrones, abandoned and neglected, the symbol of an elvish triumph against the dwarves. For the Alfar, the axe was useless. Tungdil went over and reached for the haft.
"So here's where you've been hiding."
He gave it a gentle yank, and Keenfire came away from the wall. After wiping it carefully with his sleeve, more because it had been in the hands of the Alfar than because it was actually dirty, he took a few experimental swings, testing the balance. It was perfect.
"No one will ever take you from me again," he whispered lovingly. "But I've got a job for you."
He reached into his pocket, pulled out the shard of malachite, and placed it on the third step leading up to the thrones. If any last remnants of evil, a wisp of Nodon's soul, a trace of a dark spirit, or any other demonic force, had escaped the Stone of Judgment and was sheltering in the malachite, it was about to be destroyed forever. Tungdil raised the axe, swung it once around his head, and brought it down with all his might. Light pulsed through the intarsia, and the diamonds came to life, just as they had when Tungdil had taken on Nodon in the Black Saddle. A trail of light followed the swooping Keenfire as it smashed into the stone. The malachite broke apart, shattering into tiny pieces that scattered over the dark marble floor.
"Now the mission is really over, Vrakus."
It was a relief to know that the last of the evil that had corrupted Nodon and Namora had finally been destroyed. There was one thing left to do. He took the lamps from their holders and hurled them against the walls. Oil spilled over the timber, splashing against the portraits and spattering the statues. Lowering his torch, he let the flames creep hungrily through the fuel. Tungdil left the chamber and made for the exit, lighting fire after fire on his way. He was determined to raise the tower to the ground. There would be nothing left of the elvish city by the time a dwarf, elf, or human ventured this way. Outside the tower, he looked back at the roaring flames. He was tired and he could feel the miles in his legs, but his desire to avoid sleeping in the Alvish capital spurred him on. Summoning all his energy, he made his way down the stairs and through the streets, lighting fires along the way. Even as he began his ascent to the lip of the crater, a third of John was on fire, and the blaze was spreading, fanned by the wind sent by Samusin to confound and torment him. The palace of the immortal siblings was burning like a giant torch. Red-hot debris fell from the walls, rolling down the hillside and setting fire to the buildings below. Soon, the city would be an inferno. Tungdil sat down and watched in satisfaction as the tower collapsed in a burst of flames. He could hear the sound of breaking timber, even through the roaring fire. So far, there hadn't been any screams. "The last bastion of evil, and no one's here to save it from destruction." He got up, shook his weary legs, and started up the steep stairs, determined to leave the darkness of John behind him. He was already looking forward to seeing the rising sun.
"The dead must be avenged," said a deep voice ahead of him.
A broad figure appeared on the path and swung his weapon, aiming for Tungdil's chest. The startled dwarf tried to block the blow with keenfire, but his attacker was unexpectedly strong. The weapon smashed against the haft of his axe, knocking him backward. He hit the ground hard and skidded a few paces, picking up speed down the muddy slope. He lost his helmet and came to a halt. Even as he sat up, his attacker came at him again. The glare from the fire was so bright that Tungdil could only see his silhouette.
"Too small for an elf, too big for a dwarf."
The weapon whizzed toward him again, but this time he saw it and made no attempt to parry the blow. Nothing could stop a powerful warhammer. It flew past his head as he dropped to the ground. Tungdil recognized the weapon, but its owner was dead. He fell at Perista. Sliding his axe across the mud, Tungdil took aim at his attacker's right ankle. The blade met with resistance, and Tungdil heard a groan.
"Salfalor?"
he asked incredulously. He paid for his success with a blow to the chest. His breastplate, much stronger than his usual chainmail, protected his ribs and saved him from death.
"Well guessed, Tungdil," came the reply. "You should have known better than to believe I was dead. I swore to kill you, remember?"
The hammer swung into view, on course for Tungdil's head. Tungdil jerked away at the last moment and the hammer smashed into the ground, spattering him with mud. He crawled back quickly, bracing himself against the side of the crater.
"It wasn't easy to find you, Tungdil, but I never break my word."
Struggling upright, Tungdil faced his enemy. The thirdling was holding his warhammer in both hands, and the runes on his face seemed to come alive in the flickering flames. Tungdil decided to save his breath. Salfalor would show no mercy, and neither would he. Before the thirdling could strike, Tungdil swung his axe. Thanks to keenfire, he felt confident of winning the duel, although his tired body seemed less certain. Salfalor parried the blow with the haft of the hammer, let go with one hand and smashed his armored fist into Tungdil's face. The spurs on Salfalor's knuckles tore through his skin, and for a moment Tungdil saw stars. But he didn't let go of his axe, gripping it tightly even as the thirdling punched him a second time. Tungdil didn't have time to avoid the fist, and it hit the left of his face, grazing his eye. Pain seared his mind, and his vision went pink with blood. Bellowing with rage, he thrust keenfire forward, jerking it under the thirdling's chin. Salfalor jumped away, only to swing his hammer and go back on the attack. Tungdil was hit in the chest again, but this time his breastplate caved in, pushing against his ribcage and making him gasp for breath. The combined power of Salfalor and his mighty weapon sent him flying several paces through the air. At last, he hit the ground, panting frantically. He heard Sarfalor rush forward, ready to attack. In the glow of the fire, the Thirdling looked like a living spark from the furnace of a vindictive god. His face was contorted with rage. The sight of the furious Thirdling gave Tungdil the will to fight.
I'm not dying here in Jon.
Stubbornly, he hauled himself up on his axe and, flinging his arm out to the side, set off at a run toward his antagonist. The pain was excruciating, but he shut it out. Shouting, they charged toward each other, each determined to deliver a fatal blow. At last they met, weapons colliding with a steely clatter, the blade of Tungdil's axe snagging on the hammer. The joint force of the two blows sent both weapons spinning out of the antagonist's hands. Keenfire flew to the right, the hammer to the left. Tungdil stumbled to fetch his axe while Sarfalor ran after his weapon. Tungdil bent down, picked up the axe and turned, determined not to lose sight of his enemy. For the third time, the hammer slammed into his chest. Sarfalor had got there first. The head of the hammer found the dell in his breastplate, and his sternum cracked. Pain shot through him as he flew through the air and dropped to the ground, flailing on his back like a beetle. His mind dimmed, and a chill came over him, even though the crater was filling with warmth from the burning city. Footsteps hurried toward him.
Ha! Look at the dirty Thirdling, who betrayed his own folk! It was worth dragging myself out of the mud in Perista and following you all those miles.
The Thirdling's shadow fell over him.
You deserve to die in agony, but this will do. Mir has been avenged at last.
The dwarf killers have been wiped out, gasped Tungdil. Your kinsfolk are dead. You'll be more alone than I ever was.
Sarfalor kneel beside him in the mud.
We haven't been wiped out, Tungdil. Our eyes and ears are in every clan in every kingdom, and none of your friends know they're there. As soon as they get my summons, they'll join me in their hundreds, and we'll found a new kingdom and seize the Black Range.
He grabbed Tungdil's chin.
But you won't be around to see us throw your friends out of our stronghold. The children of Lorimbur will continue the feud, but your line is dead. It's time you joined your mother and father.
Tungdil tried to clear his mind. He was on the cusp of blacking out, but he couldn't allow himself to sink into eternal sleep.
You seem to have forgotten something, he mumbled,
struggling to speak with the Thirdling's hand around his mouth. The smooth, tattooed skull came closer, and Sarfalor peered at him mockingly. Behind him, a house collapsed in a blaze of flames and sparks shot out, dancing around the Thirdling's head and giving him a demonic look.
Let me think. You're lying in the mud, dying of your wounds. What could I possibly have forgotten?
The warrior's first commandment, gasped Tungdil. Never let go of your axe.
He sat up with a jerk, raising his right hand and striking with all his might. Keenfire bit horizontally into the skull of the startled Sarfalor, embedding itself in the bone. The Thirdling went down as if felled by an arrow. His body twitched frantically, determined not to die, but his glazed, bloodied eyes showed that his soul had already departed.
Boindil taught me well.
Unable to rise, Tungdil lay in the mud, racked with pain. Looking up at the stars and with one hand on Keenfire, he waited for death to claim him from the burning Alvish city. But death never came. Tungdil still sprawled on the path, listened as the flames retreated from the edge of the crater and returned to the city in search of wood. He could sense that death was watching him like a scavenger hoping for food, but something was holding the darkness at bay. Little by little the pain subsided, until he felt confident enough to fall asleep without worrying that he might never wake up. When he opened his eyes, the sun had barely moved in the sky, and he felt rested, but hungry. He sat up as best he could in his buckled armor, then unfastened the straps and took off his breastplate. Carefully, he touched his chest. The bones were intact, and the pain had gone. His fingers came into contact with the pouch containing the diamond. He pulled out the stone and held it to the light.
Was I saved by the grace of Rakus? Or by the diamond?
He glanced at Salfalor's corpse and was surprised by its rotten state. Birds and maggots had stripped the flesh from his face, and his body was bloated with gas as if death were mocking the once proud warrior.
How long have I been asleep?
He got up and staggered backwards. John had vanished. Every last building in the city had been razed to the ground, leaving nothing but ash. Stone foundations were the only indication of where the Alfar's gruesome tower had once stood. There was no sign of smoke, and the roaring fire had fallen silent. He prodded the ash gingerly with his finger. It was cold. Gathering his damaged armor, he hurried up the path. The mud had hardened to dirt, and he felt strong and healthy, his wounds completely healed. He decided that Vrakus had kept his inner furnace burning while he was asleep.
The stone can't work magic on its own. And I'm certainly no magus.
On emerging from the crater, he spotted an army of humans and elves approaching the city from the south, no doubt alarmed by the smoke. Sunlight glittered on their banners and armor.
There's nothing left for them to do, he thought.
Rather than wait for them to arrive, he struck out at once on a northeasterly bearing. The journey to the Brown Range took many orbits. Tungdil enjoyed the solitude and had plenty of time to think. He thought about Belindis and Mir and what had happened between them, the Thirdlings, the future, and where he wanted to go. To the Freelings, to the Fifthlings, or to Gandogar. As he crossed the border into the hills of Urgon, his plan took shape. His march through Urgon coincided with the preparations for the coronation. The fate of King Bellatane was the talk of the boarding houses where Tungdil sought shelter and food. The Mad King's betrayal of the allied army had cost him the support of his subjects and lost him his throne. Tungdil was pleased to be back among humans. It reminded him of happier times in Lot Ionan's school, when he had been nothing but an ordinary dwarf with a love of books and a talent for metalworking. The journey through Urgon took him through green valleys, over lofty summits, and through the narrow mountain passes that tested his agility as well as his endurance. At last he arrived at the Forthning Kingdom. The sentries took him straight to Gandogar. The Forthling's talent for cutting and polishing gemstones was on full display in the stronghold. The passageways were decorated with pictures composed of brightly colored gems. Blood-red rubies, deep blue sapphires, moss-green emeralds, black tourmaline, pink quartz, finely worked agate. Every inch of the Forthling stronghold seemed to sparkle and shimmer with precious stones. Tungdil, dishevelled from his journey through Gowragar and Urgon, his clothes dusty and his boots worn, entered the throne room and inclined his head, revealing his sun-bleached hair.
Tungdil Coldhand!
Gandagai hailed him from his throne of pure quartz. He seemed exceedingly relieved.
Thank Vrakus you're alive! How are you?
He signalled for him to sit.
Salfalor turned up in Perista, he continued,
while stewards hurried in with refreshments for the tired and thirsty dwarf.
He killed a dozen of our warriors before he disappeared. We were worried he...
Tungdil emptied his tankard in a single draught.
"He's dead, Your Majesty," he interrupted.
"He came after me and ambushed me in Jon."
He pulled Keenfire from its sheath and wrapped his knuckles against the axe head.
"I claimed what was mine from the Alfar. John is a dreadful place, and they'd hidden the axe in a tower of bones. After I'd found it, It occurred to him that it might be better to keep the details of his duel with Salphalor to himself. Well, I came back here.
You were gone a long time. Every orbit we kept waiting and hoping for news, but spring went by and no one knew where you were.
Tungdil tried not to show his surprise.
Urgon is a kingdom after my heart. I thought I'd see a bit of the land.
He decided to change the subject.
I suppose you've finished the replicas? You made an excellent job of the drawings.
Gandragar called for his master jeweler, who carried in the diamonds on a crystal tray lined with black velvet. The gems were beautifully arranged as if strung together on a necklace. To Tungdil's untrained eye, they looked identical. They seemed to resemble each other in every detail. He took out the real diamond and placed it among the others.
It's impossible to tell the difference.
He counted the gems, 14 in total.
You've made too many, he said. 7 human monarchs, 5 dwarves, and Lutisil, 13.
The Fourthling King and the Master Jeweler compared the diamonds and nodded.
They're perfect, declared Gandragar. But we haven't made too many, Tungdil. 5 for the Dwarven Monarchs, including 1 for the future King of the Thirdlings, and an extra 1 for you. If anyone is worthy of the diamond, it's you. Don't feel obliged to accept. We can destroy it if you'd rather.
No, he said quickly. I'd be honored. Gandragar picked up the corners of the velvet cloth, allowing the diamonds to slide into the middle. Tungdil lost sight of the Eoil's diamond among its lesser fellows. The High King gathered the corners and shook the cloth, allowing the diamonds to jostle for position. At last, he let go of one end, and the stones bounced onto the tray.
"Summon the messengers," he commanded.
The doors to the throne room flew open, and an elf, 7 men and 4 dwarves were ushered in. One by one they stepped forward to choose a diamond. Some barely glanced at the tray, while others took their time as if they hoped to pick the magic diamond. 2 stones remained on the tray. Gandragar asked the master jeweler to offer them to Tungdil.
I'd like you to choose, he said.
Tungdil reached for the right-hand stone, wavered for a moment, then picked it up. Gandragar took the last diamond.
These gifts are a sign of our unity, he said, turning to the messengers. Take them to your rulers and tell them these words. Like these stones, so will be our thoughts. Remember these diamonds in times of trouble and honor the alliance. Henceforth, our hearts shall beat as one for Gerdlegard.
He waved them away. The messengers bowed and took their leave, and the doors closed behind them with a bang.
Right. I've got a question for you, Tungdil Goldhand.
The High King signalled for Tungdil to be seated.
You've had some time to reflect on your journey. Will you be my counsellor?
Kingdom of Eidoslane, Gerdlegard, Summer, 6236th Solar Cycle. Tungdil didn't need to tell his legs where to take him. He had travelled this way 100 times before. The journey was full of memories, sad memories. Summer had brought the promise of an excellent harvest to Eidoslane. The fields were full of vegetables and crops, and bees buzzed between brightly coloured flowers. A warm wind caressed the lush green meadows where the cows were grazing. They turned their big brown eyes toward the wayfarer, before lowering their heads to focus on the grass.
It looks exactly the same.
Tungdil rounded the final bend in the road and came to a halt. Even from a distance, he could see the wreckage of Lot Ionan's gates. Strewn among the bushes were scraps of rusty armour and gnawed bone, all that was left of the orcs who had done battle with Tungdil and the twins on their previous visit.
No, he thought somberly. Some things have changed.
The orcs were gone for good. Judging by their remains, they had infested the kingdom. But the Stone of Judgment had put an end to their evil souls. Prince Malon had sent an army into the caves of Toboribor, and his men had struggled through the hot, dark passageways without finding a single orc. Guarding Girdlegard isn't easy. He thought of his dead friends, and of Boendal, buried at the High Pass. He had visited the Secondling's grave with Boindil, and they had wept for their lost companion and twin. Boindil's inner furnace seemed to have cooled, and the glint in his eye had gone. It seemed to Tungdil that he resembled his brother more closely, and even his speech was calmer and more considered. Death leaves its mark on the living as well. He approached the dark entrance to the tunnel, climbing over the wreckage of the gates and entering the cool, earthy passageway. After a few paces, he stopped. The tunnel was still blocked where he and the twins had cut away the struts and brought down the roof on the heads of the furious orcs who were baying for their blood. Tons of rock had crashed to the ground, barricading the tunnel. The only way into the school was to burrow through. Tungdil stroked the frayed neckerchief that he wore around his wrist. It was a present from Frala, the warm-hearted kitchen maid who had been like a sister to him, and who had died in the orcish massacre with her daughters, Sunya and Ikana. A lump came to his throat and he forced himself to swallow, but the sadness was lodged inside him. It's time I cleared up around here. It was a monumental task. Orbit after orbit passed as he inched his way forward with a pick and a shovel, carting out the rubble and building new struts. He threw the crushed remains of the orcs into a pile and burned their bones, allowing their ashes to scatter on the wind. A single skull marked the site of the battle, a reminder of the dwarven victory and a warning to future invaders. At last, he reached a section of tunnel that had survived the skirmish with the orcs. The struts and the walls looked perfectly stable, so he continued on his way. From time to time he found an orcish skeleton. Falling debris accounted for most of the casualties, but some of the beasts had starved amid the rubble. Tungdil guessed from their gnawed bones that they had resorted to eating each other, though one of the skeletons bore no signs of damage. He eyed the creature's skull with distaste. You were the last orc standing, were you? Even feasting on your comrades didn't save you in the end. He dragged the bones out of the tunnel and lit another fire, determined that nothing should remain of Nodom's hordes. Next, he began a search for the skeletons of the men and women who had lived at the school, but all he found was a small collection of bones, which he decided to bury on top of a little mound opposite the gates. He found a boulder and sculpted it into a tombstone, then forged their names in metal letters and hammered them into the stone. Laying down his tools, he sat on the mound and gazed at the hills and the human settlements. Never had the kingdom of Ida Slain looked so peaceful. He wiped the sweat and tears from his eyes. A familiar figure came into view, hurrying down the path, spotting him on the mound and running to meet him. He got up to welcome the visitor. I wasn't expecting you, he said, giving Belindis a powerful hug. I suppose they sent you to talk me into settling into one of the kingdoms. Did Gandagar think I'd agree to be his counselor if you asked on his behalf? Belindis let her backpack slide to the ground and sat down on the mound. Sighing, she rubbed her ankles. I should have brought a pony. It's a long way on foot. Noticing the tombstone, she gave Tungdil another hug. There was no need for words. They sat in silence, watching the clouds as the blue sky turned red, then black, and the first stars appeared overhead. Everyone says hello, said Belindis at last. It would take too long to list all the names. You've got a lot of friends, you know. And Rodario wants to know about the orc who asked for directions. She smiled.
I don't think he got it.
Tungdil laughed. He'll have to wait for the punchline. He was silent for a while.
I'm afraid you'll have to tell the High King that I haven't decided how much longer I'm staying.
I can't work out where I belong. My heart belongs to the dwarves, but I like the company of humans, and sometimes I think I'm more like a human than a dwarf. They're not as rigid in their thinking.
What about the Freelings?
I can't go back to Trovegold, not now. It reminds me of things I'd rather forget. He looked at her gravely. As soon as I've made my decision, I'll let Gandagar know. Maybe I'll go to the Outer Lands and look for the dwarves who carved that strange rune. If Gandagar needs me, he has only to say. She tried to smile. It's sad, you know. For the first time in history, we've got a real hero. And instead of living with his kinsfolk and sharing his wisdom with the High King, he worries about what to do with himself.
She tilted back her head to look up at a star that was shining more brightly than its fellows.
Maybe it's part of being a hero. If you didn't question yourself, you might get big-headed.
Tell me about the Dwarven Kingdoms, he said. I'm tired of thinking about myself.
Belindis thought for a moment. There isn't much to report. The feud with the Thirdlings is over, and the dwarves are united at last. A combined army from all five kingdoms is guarding the Eastern Pass.
He was about to tell her about Salfalor's threat, but he changed his mind.
What about the Freelings?
Still free, she reported. King Gemmel decided to carry on as before. He'll welcome any dwarf who wants to settle in his realm. It's better that way. The Freelings wouldn't be happy in our kingdoms, but we'll trade with each other and keep in touch.
Any news from the rest of Girdlygard?
She shrugged. Everything's back to normal, except the beasts are gone. Even the dark water has disappeared, and it's fine to drink from the lakes. Every last bit of evil has been destroyed, she sighed. It's almost too good to be true.
Tungdil remembered how the Malachite had shattered before his eyes.
There's nothing left that can harm us.
The dwarves will see to it that Girdlygard stays safe.
Oh, said Belindis, uncertainly. I almost forgot. There's a rumor that the diamond for Queen Issica hasn't arrived. No one has seen the messenger or his guards.
What do you mean?
Tungdil shook his head incredulously.
What if it's the mag-
He broke off, remembering that Belindis knew nothing of the magic stone.
But it's a symbol of friendship.
People are saying it was stolen. Queen Issica is scouring Ran Ribastur for the thieves.
You can't sell a stone like that. The culprits will be captured.
Tungdil tried not to think about it. He was tired of being a hero. Someone else can deal with it.
What about you, Belindis? How's life in the Fifthling Kingdom?
It's going well. We've rebuilt the halls, just as you said we should.
She flashed him a wonderful smile.
You'd be proud if you could see it. Even Giselbert would be proud. Glaimbar is doing his best to be a good king, and he's getting there, Tungdil.
There was a short silence.
Is he a good husband as well?
She swallowed.
He did everything he could.
He stopped gazing at the stars and looked at her sharply.
Did?
He let me go, she said tremulously. One morning he put his arms around me, looked at me solemnly, and told me he was lifting the iron band.
She paused for a moment, regaining her composure.
And Tungdil saw doubt, hope, and fear in her beautiful eyes. He could hardly believe what he was hearing.
I asked what I'd done wrong.
What did he say? Said Tungdil, his throat suddenly dry.
He said that he promised someone to make me happy, and he couldn't keep his promise without letting me go.
He told me to follow my heart.
She hid her face in her hands, crying tears of relief.
I pray to Vrakas every night, asking him to bring us together. Is it wrong of me to be glad?
Even the stars seemed to be rejoicing.
Thank you, Fracas, thank you.
Tungdil wanted to jump up and shout the good news across Goragar.
Fracas has given me my heart's desire.
Restraining himself, he stroked her short hair, remembering her ordeal at the hands of the Eoil. She lifted her palms from her tear-streaked face and looked at him tenderly.
No, it's not wrong to be happy, he assured her, pulling her close.
Silently, he thanked Glaimbar, whose selfless gesture commanded his unconditional respect. He kissed Belindis, disentangled himself gently, and bent on one knee.
Belindis Steelfinger of the Clan of the Steelfingers, daughter of Borengar, will you meld your heart to mine and stay with me always, even if we live 1,000 cycles?
Belindis dried her tears.
My heart has been melded to yours for as long as I've known you, Tungdil Goldhand. It's yours to keep.
They embraced, squeezing each other tightly, while the moon rose above them, casting a silvery glow over Eidoslane. Nothing could separate them now.
This has been a Hachette audio production of The War of the Dwarves, written by Marcus Heitz, translated by Sally Ann Spencer, read by Neil Dixon, produced by Dennis Keo, recorded by John Kavarik, sound editing by Fred Koch and Mike Sandoval, mixing and mastering by Jeremy Wesley, production supervised by Tommy Heron. The War of the Dwarves is also available in print and digital formats from Orbit, an imprint of Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2004 by Piper Verlag GmbH, Munich. English translation copyright 2010 by Sally Ann Spencer. Audio production copyright 2017 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.